ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Monday, the 1st of December. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, hundreds missing in devastating floods across Asia. And the fish species at the forefront of the complex fight against the crown of thorns starfish.
Not because they eat the crown of thorns, but because they eat the fish that eat the crabs that eat the crown of thorns babies.
There are renewed warnings today that Australia's east coast could experience widespread power blackouts as early as 2027, once the nation's largest coal-fired power station, Eraring, is retired. A report by Australia's energy market operator, AEMO, says investment delays in critical infrastructure have undermined the security of the grid, and costs will rise for consumers if more isn't done to prepare for coal-fired power stations coming offline over the next decade. Here's Bridget Fitzgerald.
A key part of making sure Australians have access to reliable, steady electricity is to make sure that any big power surges or drops in the grid are managed. That's where a synchronous condenser comes in.
A device to stabilise the grid should there be any unintended fluctuations on voltage or frequency on the grid.
Glenn Thompson is the Chief Executive Officer of a company called Australian Energy Operations, which owns and operates what's about to become one of Australia's largest synchronous condensers, set to be up and running at a site in Ararat in Western Victoria by the end of the year. Australia's going to need more of them, much more, to do a job that's currently being done by coal-fired power stations.
Power stations have what we refer to as synchronous generation, so they provide that stability as part of their ongoing operations. And as those large generators retire and we have more and more intermittent generation in the form of solar and wind farms, then you need something else to replace that.
The problem is this technology is not coming online fast enough. In a report on Australia's energy transition out today, Australia's energy market operator warns there hasn't been enough done to prepare for the security and reliability of the national energy market in the decade ahead. Daniel Westerman is AEMO's chief executive.
It highlights the main transition points in the national electricity market over the next decade and the collective actions that are really needed to enable that next phase of Australia's energy transition.
The report warns that eastern Australia could face widespread blackouts once the nation's largest coal-fired power station, Eraring, closes in 2027.
Coal-fired power stations are retiring, and this is not new news. 10 have retired since 2012, and the remaining fleet are getting old. So there's a set of transition points that keep that steady heartbeat when each of those coal-fired power stations retire.
Another challenge is the flood of energy from household solar into the grid.
There are 4 million homes out there with rooftop solar who have been just the driving force of the energy transition, and sometimes the flood of that power from rooftops can create a bit of a challenge for how the system operates, and so there's a transition set of transition points to manage those too.
Transgrid, which operates the electricity transmission network in New South Wales and the ACT, has fast-tracked plans for synchronous condensers at 5 sites in preparation for Eraring's closure, but AEMO's report states they won't be delivered until 2028. Alison Reeve is the director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Grattan Institute.
I think what you've got here is sort of a failure of planning, really, rather than it's not a failing of engineering. It's people knew what needed to be done, they just didn't do it in time.
There are solutions, but it'll likely involve a cost that'd be passed on to consumers. One option for AEMO and other stakeholders, including the New South Wales Government and Origin, which owns Eraring, could be a delay in Eraring's retirement. But Alison Reeve says there are also other possibilities.
The market operator could intervene directly in the market. So what they would do there is, for example, direct certain generators that they have to to run at certain times. This has already happened a couple of times in South Australia with gas generators. It has happened previously in New South Wales with some of the snowy hydro generators.
In a statement, the New South Wales Acting Minister for Climate Change and Energy, Paul Scully, says the New South Wales government is accelerating the delivery of synchronous condensers by 18 months. He also indicated Eraring may continue operating until April 2029. A spokesperson for Transgrid says it acknowledges there are risks of gaps in the system's strength after the retirement of Eraring, but says Transgrid is evaluating tenders for the critical project and has shaved 2 years off the delivery schedule for the equipment.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting there. Overseas now, and this week's shaping up as pivotal for Ukraine-Russia peace talks. US Special Envoy Steve Witkoff is due to travel to Moscow this week after weekend talks in Florida with Ukrainian negotiators. Meanwhile, one of Russia's leading investigative journalists says the Kremlin is gearing up for a decades-long battle with the West as its shadow war with Europe escalates. Here's Nicole Johnston.
Russian drones flying into NATO's eastern flank, its ships sailing off the coast of Europe, accused of cutting undersea cables. This is the shadow war between Russia and the West. Russian investigative journalist Andrei Soldatov, who now reports from exile in London, says the hybrid war is gathering speed.
For the Russian intelligence agencies, it is an existential war. Not with Ukraine, but with the West. They are ready to invest more in war and more in this war, which is extremely important for the Russian spies. They really believe that they are in a century-long war with Western intelligence agencies. They believe that now it's a third round of this war. That makes things very, very emotional. It also means that they really believe that in this war, the stakes are as high as the survival of the Russian state.
Andrei Soldatov, what has led you to that conclusion that they believe they're in the third round of this war?
They believe that every time the Russian state collapsed, and remember that throughout the 20th century, Russia went through two horrible catastrophes, the Russian Revolution, which destroyed the Russian Empire, and then the 1991, the collapse of the Soviet Union, which Putin called a geopolitical catastrophe. And that means that for Russian spies, it's not extremely clear why these things happened. They tend to blame the West, and they believe in all sorts of conspiracies because they sort of remember what it was like 20, 40, 70 years ago.
How are we going to see the Russian security and intelligence services accelerating this shadow war against Europe?
Unfortunately, the problem here is that the Russian intelligence agencies, they just don't know how to react to this new challenge. And it is a new challenge. We tend to compare things which are happening now with what happened during the Cold War. Unfortunately, the level of sabotage activities we see now is absolutely unprecedented. Soviet intelligence agencies, the KGB, always had an option of carrying out sabotage attacks in the West, but never activated this option. They believed that that option was good only for the full-out hot war with the West. And that is why there is no template in the West right now as to how to react to Russian sabotage attacks.
As for ending the war, last month's leaked US 28-point peace plan did not appear to come from the Kremlin's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, but was instead partly drafted by the chief of Russia's sovereign wealth fund, Kirill Dmitriev.
These people are getting more powerful. The only two institutions which became more prominent during these 3.5, almost 4 years of war are the army and the Russian intelligence agencies. And we see that all three Russian major intelligence agencies have been involved in negotiations with the Americans. The reason why they're getting more and more involved is very simple. If you are dealing with the country, which is run by a dictator, you talk to the people, maybe nasty people, but who actually can deliver. And in the country like Russia, unfortunately, the people with the guns, they can deliver.
That's Russian investigative journalist Andrei Soldatov, Nicole Johnston reporting. Around 900 people have been killed and hundreds are still missing after a powerful cyclone left a trail of destruction across Southeast Asia. Heavy monsoon rain drenched parts of Indonesia, Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia and Sri Lanka, causing flash flooding and landslides and leaving thousands stranded. At least 80,000 residents have been evacuated while crews are still searching for those trapped as tropical cyclone Ditwa now makes its way towards southern India. Kathleen O'Connor has the story.
In the north central province of Sri Lanka, an Air Force helicopter drops fuel to residents stranded on the roofs of their homes. Hours earlier, powerful tropical cyclone Ditwa tore through the region, causing the worst flooding in decades. More than 1 million residents across 25 districts have been impacted and a state of emergency has been declared. 15,000 homes have been destroyed and several hospitals are underwater. According to the United Nations, hundreds are dead or missing and nearly 200,000 people are sheltering in safety centres as rescue efforts continue. In a national address, President Anurakumara Dissanayake described the scale of destruction.
As a country, we are facing the largest and most challenging natural disaster in our history. We also recognise that what we are undertaking is the most difficult rescue operation in our nation's history. This is the first time the entire country has been struck by such a disaster.
Sri Lankan journalist Kamanthi Wickremasinghe is in the capital, Colombo.
People are being safely taken to safe centres and temporary schools that are being used as makeshift shelters. When we speak to farmers in rural areas, they observe unseasonal rainfall patterns, which obviously could be results of climate change.
In Hat Yai, a city in Thailand's far south near the Malaysian border, the storm has passed. But the main streets remain submerged in water. 25,000 people have been displaced. Karishma Vyas is ABC's Asia editor. She's in Bangkok, returning from the flood zone in Thailand.
They had absolutely no warning that this was coming, so they made no preparations whatsoever. And in the aftermath of these floods that suddenly gushed in on November 21st and in the days after, we saw people just trapped, unable to move, unable to get in to get their relatives, unable to get out to save themselves.
Further south in Malaysia, search and rescue teams are trying to save those trapped in floodwaters that inundated homes within seconds. Armas Rahman tried to grab vital supplies before fleeing.
I wanted to grab my belongings in my house. The water was high already, just above my waist when I entered, but my wife and mother-in-law needed me to get their medicine. That's why I was thinking of how I could save my things.
Meanwhile, in the North Sumatra province in Indonesia, reports of casualties are pouring in from the Western Island, devastated by landslides and flooding. Many areas are cut off due to blocked roads, while damage to telecommunications infrastructure has hampered communication. Further north in Vietnam, scores of people have been reported dead, while many children have been rescued with plastic tubs and other makeshift flotation devices. Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade has announced it will provide $1 million in humanitarian support to help with the cleanup in Sri Lanka. Authorities in India are now bracing for impact as the cyclone approaches the coast, cancelling flights, closing down schools and setting up temporary shelters.
Kathleen O'Connor with that report. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Back home, and tens of thousands of residents across the country are set to lose free-to-air TV with their fibre optic network provider Opticom decommissioning the service. The company has blamed ageing infrastructure for its decision, and for some customers, the troubles don't end there, with regular internet outages taking out whole suburbs. Grace Atta with this report.
When Leah Ray and her family moved into a new suburb on the outskirts of Darwin in 2023, she was sold on the promise of it being a smart community with top-of-the-line underground technology. But things weren't quite what they seemed.
We moved into a smart suburb. Ultimately, it was the opposite of that. Very, very backward compared to the suburb that I moved from. definitely not smart in my view.
In Leah's suburb and in more than 500,000 other properties across Australia, the fibre optic network is owned by a private company called Opticom, as opposed to the publicly owned National Broadband Network. Unlike the NBN, Opticom facilitates internet connectivity as well as access to free-to-air television. But in September, about 10% of their customers were told free-to-air would no longer be provided over fibre and they'd need to install an antenna or use streaming apps instead. Leah says that's unacceptable.
We shouldn't have been required to have any other additional costs to get our free-to-air on. We bought into the suburb knowing that we would have access to free-to-air television and then suddenly it's gone.
While Leah was eventually able to install an antenna, not everyone is so lucky. Like Brisbane retiree Mike, who lives in a multi-storey retirement village.
The situation that they have presented us with is just not good enough. And particularly for those that aren't particularly mobile and can't get out of their units very easily, free-to-air TV is a vital and important part of their everyday life.
Ryan Knowles runs retirement villages in Brisbane and says installing an antenna would require re-cabling the multi-storey building at a huge cost.
Our general assessment of people we've spoken to would be running to a couple of $100,000 to re-cable it with major antenna on the roof to service the apartments.
And streaming apps aren't accessible for everyone.
Not everyone in our villages have the digital acumen to handle digital TV.
In a statement, an Opticom spokesperson told the ABC the equipment used to receive free-to-air television in these communities was reaching end of life and interfering with other upgrades to the network. Industry regulators say rules around network infrastructure providers like Opticom don't apply to free-to-air television. Instead, they deal with complaints around internet issues, which dozens of Opticom customers have told the ABC there are plenty of, with regular internet outages sometimes spanning from 2 days to 2 weeks. Leah says she's installed a satellite dish at her home to avoid the outages.
There's constantly someone saying, oh, internet's dropped out again and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I do see that quite often.
Associate Professor in Engineering at RMIT University, Mark Gregory, says current legislation leaves regulators with very limited powers over infrastructure providers like Opticom, and he's calling for that to change.
I believe that all companies involved in the telecommunications industry, whether they're an infrastructure provider, a wholesaler or a retailer, they should be subject to the regulators, and we should have performance standards that the regulators are able to enforce.
The Telecommunications Ombudsman agrees and has also called on the federal government to develop service quality standards for infrastructure providers. But until that happens, many customers are left going without.
Grace Usser reporting there. National home values rose 1% last month, the third consecutive month of strong growth, although the two largest cities, Sydney and Melbourne, were below the national average. On top of the housing affordability and supply crisis, home buyers and mortgage borrowers are mulling over new lending regulations. From February, the Australian Prudential and Regulatory Authority will make banks limit the share of new home loans with a high debt-to-income ratio to just 20% of their new mortgage lending. Adrian Lee is an Associate Professor in Property and Real Estate at Deakin University, and he joined me earlier. Professor Lee, firstly, what is a debt-to-income limit, the type of which that APRA is going to be bringing in February next year?
Yes, so it's the total debt that a borrower has divided by their before-tax income. So it's a sort of ratio that APRA is using to limit risky loans.
What is the point of a debt-to-income limit? What is the desired outcome here?
Yes, to make sure that whoever is borrowing can actually afford those loans so they can pay the principal and interest on time with what income they have.
And what other countries have debt-to-income limits and what results have been studied in those countries?
A fair few countries. So, for example, New Zealand, Ireland has it. The one that from an article about Norway, they have it similar to what APRA is doing, just to limit risky loans. And the results are that if you have these, they can be a bit inequitable, as in those with lower incomes cannot easily move to better areas.
And what does the Norwegian experience say about the property market in general? Did house prices go up, down, or stay the same?
Yeah, so the Norwegian study, it was a modelling exercise, and they did find that by having these limits, they do depress prices and also, of course, prevent risky loans, which is the primary objective of these limits.
Interventions like these in the property market, sort of like first home buyer grants, have been hotly debated over their effect on house prices and demand. How do you assess these debt-to-income limits for the same kind of effects?
Look, they're a bit more specific. It's just a more sharper way to limit risky loans than, say, the Reserve Bank with interest rates. So this is a kind of experimental at the moment, just to see if can we prevent systemic risk in the loan sector.
Can you just elaborate a bit more about what you mean?
Yeah, the whole point is that we don't want more risky loans because this will make borrowers default, and the default could cause a housing market crash, and that can cause economy-wide problems like in the global financial crisis. So trying to prevent that using very specific tool to limit the risky loans.
Adrian Lee is an Associate Professor in Property and Real Estate at Deakin University. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Andy. My pleasure.
To the Great Barrier Reef now, and a local ecology success story. The crown of thorns starfish has long been one of the reef's biggest threats, reproducing in plague proportions and devouring up to 90% of coral in some areas. But scientists believe that moves to protect some species of fish along the reef is helping to keep the crown of thorns starfish numbers in check. Here's Luke Radford.
In the clear blue waters off the Queensland coast, divers survey a stretch of the Great Barrier Reef. They're not here for the coral. Rather, they're hunting for a starfish. It's called the crown of thorns, and CSIRO's Dr. Scott Condy says it causes enormous damage.
They undergo these huge outbreaks only about every 10 to 15 years, and they just basically swarm through the reef eating coral. You know, a single large crown of thorns starfish can spawn like 200 million eggs at a time.
Since 1962, scientists have feared that if left unchecked, the crown of thorns could push parts of the reef that are already struggling over the edge. Dr. Condy and his team have been studying what keeps them in check.
Based on sort of all the data and so on that's been collected on the Great Barrier Reef the last decades, we put together a model which has clearly demonstrated the huge role that some of the large fish have in controlling the crown of thorns starfish. And these fish happen to be also the ones that we like to catch and eat ourselves.
Dr. Daniela Ciccarelli is an ecologist at the Australian Institute of Marine Science and also worked on the study.
We were quite astounded to see how much of a difference it made. Those protections from fishing and those fisheries management strategies have had quite a big impact in the model on the amounts of COTS outbreaks that we have on the reef and the amounts of coral that has been lost. And essentially, it's protected the corals by protecting the fish.
Using computer modelling, the researchers say fishing restrictions introduced back in 2004 have helped ensure healthy populations of these starfish-eating species.
We've been learning that the main predators of adult crown of thorns starfish are emperors, like red-throat emperors, like spangled emperors. And then we've also put groupers into the model, like coral trout, not because they eat the crown of thorns, but because they eat the fish that eat the crabs that eat the crown of thorns babies.
Researchers now recommend continuing the current system of manual control, where teams of divers hunt and kill the starfish. Dr. David Williamson is Assistant Director of the Crown of Thorns Control Program for the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority.
Once we're able to identify where the aggregations of the starfish are on every individual reef, we're then able to put full dive teams in, and then we sort of systematically move in a line through those cull sites and reduce the numbers using a lethal injection of usually household vinegar.
The control program effectively works hand in hand with the predatory fish by targeting the biggest starfish on some of the most important reefs.
So we draw upon a whole lot of information from coral larval connectivity information, so how important is each individual reef in producing coral larvae for replenishment of reefs? What's the current status of coral on those reefs? Where are the outbreaks at the moment, the COTS outbreaks? Where are they likely to move to next year? Which areas are logistically feasible to work?
While the researchers say this is an ecological success story, they warn the escalating impacts of climate change will limit its effectiveness in the future.
Luke Radford, and that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, I'm Sydney Peed, filling in for Sam Hawley for the ABC News Daily podcast. Every day, millions of us take vitamin supplements hoping for a health boost, but there's been a sharp rise in people suffering numbness and nerve damage after unknowingly overdosing on vitamin B6. Today, reporter for the ABC's 7:30 program, Tom Hartley, on his year-long investigation into the surge in cases and the regulators' long overdue crackdown. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.